Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. There are a gazillion cookbooks out there for every cuisine and style of cooking, and while the cooking techniques, ingredients, time, and temperature are spelled out in all of these books, they often skimp on that last part of cooking, knowing when your recipe is done. How many times have you followed a recipe to the letter only to find your finished product either overdone or undercooked? Well, my guest's latest book focuses completely on when to stop cooking. James Peterson is an award-winning food writer, cookbook author, and former chef with 7 James Beard Foundation Awards to his credit. His 15th book is titled Done, A Cook's Guide to Knowing When Food is Perfectly Cooked. It's published by Chronicle Books. Using sound, smell, look, and feel, as well as his ample photography, Peterson shows us exactly how to cook meat, vegetables, seafood, and desserts, sauces, soufflés, and risotto to the perfect degree of doneness. He joins us today on Studio Tulsa. James Peterson, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Your new book, Done, is on getting the perfect cook. Why did you decide to write a book about this particular subject? Your first essay is really about people often overcook, they undercook, and you always worry about doing one or the other when you're in the kitchen.
Well, that's exactly it, Rich. Most people who say they can't cook just look at you and say, well, I don't know when it's done. And it's true. I go to dinner parties often, and people are cooking a Sam or whatever they're cooking, and they don't know when it's done. Usually they call on me to determine when it's done. And of course, if I don't get it right, it's very embarrassing.
Well, one of the things you write is that a lot of times, and especially when you're cooking by the book, so to speak, it's all about temperature, internal temperatures, and times. And this is a pretty inaccurate way to cook most things from what I read.
Well, temperature's okay. The problem is not everyone has one of those little instant read thermometers. They're expensive, and not everyone has them, and you're often in situations where you don't have access to one, and it's good to know how to tell like a chef would know. Chefs don't use thermometers.
Well, and what about times, using time to cook?
Well, time is good for a parameter, but most of the time, it's wrong. Like, I see directions, I think it's 10 minutes a pound for cooking turkey, or maybe it's 20 minutes. It's some huge number, which guarantees your turkey will be completely dry. And the temperatures are often wrong. Like, they'll say to cook turkey at 160 in between the thigh and the back, which is where you usually measure. And if you do that, it'll be extremely overcooked.
And that's the one thing I think was most interesting about your book is the idea of the temperature you should shoot for is much lower than most recommendations. Of course, you know, with E. coli and everything and all the scare of food, a lot of times people are recommending you cook things a lot longer than we used to and a lot hotter temperature. And, of course, you're saying, no, that's not necessarily the case.
I don't worry too much about salmonella because it tends, if you have salmonella, it tends to remain on the surface of the bird or in the cavity, perhaps, but not inside the musculature. Otherwise, the thing would have had a systemic sepsis, would have probably died. So the cooking, the roasting or whatever, there's no problem about it killing E. coli. Now, I don't want to be really quoted on that because I'm not a doctor, I'm not a bacteriologist, but that seems logical to me.
So you recommend cooking things quite a bit less as far as doneness goes, as far as temperature.
Yes, and one mistake I've made in the past is to warn people that it is going to be pink inside. Where the thigh opens up, it will be pink, but it won't be raw. If you cook it till there's no color to it at all, it's going to be overcooked. And people are frightened by this pink thing. I got a call a few months ago from a woman. She said, "Is this James Peterson?" I said, "Yes." She said, "Well, I'd like you to know that you ruined my Thanksgiving dinner." No. So she walks me through the whole thing. She followed my recipe, and step by step, it works according to plan. She took it to 140. She opened it up, and it was pink. And she flipped. And I said, "Well, what'd you do?" She said, "I threw it all in the trash." And I said, "Well, didn't you at least eat the breast meat, which would have been perfect?" She said, no, we didn't eat any of it.
Well, why do you think we're so scared of eating pink meat, especially when it comes to poultry and fowl?
I think because if we've ever encountered undercooked poultry or fowl, I mean by undercooked, I mean it's really raw inside, it's really revolting. So I think there's fear of that, and I think there's fear of microorganisms. Yeah. Like you said, people think, gee, I got to cook the thing to death, it's full of salmonella, which is a little bit analogous to the trichinosis in pork thing, which in a way, although there's very little trichinosis anymore, but in a way that makes more sense because the trichinosis is actually inside the musculature, inside the meat.
And that's another meat that we tend to overcook a lot because, again, that fear is still very prevalent. So you cook a pork until it is completely white.
Oh, I know. It's terrible. But you get, pretentious restaurants now ask you how you want it done. And really, there's only, I guess people are paranoid. They see a tiny bit of pink. But when it's cooked properly, it's the equivalent of medium. You're like you cook veal. And it's just a little pink inside, but not raw by any means, and juicy. If it's all white, it'll be dry.
Now, one of the things you write at the very beginning of the book is about how in really determining doneness, you're using all of your senses. Give us a sense of the things you're doing to understand when food is done besides using a cookbook, a temp, a time to figure out when things are done.
Well, I use touch a lot. I touch the meat to feel how resilient it is, if it springs back or not. When meat reaches a certain temperature, it becomes, as I say, resilient. It bounces back to the touch. So that means that you're at medium, or in beef case, you're medium rare. But as soon as that starts to happen, you're at medium rare. When it's fully developed, you're at medium. You also look at it. You look at the juices and the formation of juices. Once a roast starts releasing juices, you're getting there, because the heat is penetrating into the meat. So there are a couple of ways. And chicken, let's see what the sound. I certainly use sound when I put a piece of meat in a pan. If it doesn't sizzle, I know I haven't heated the pan enough to sizzle. Mm-hmm. Smell, of course, is pretty obvious. But one thing I use smell for is if I'm making a jus and I'm evaporating it, I'm taking liquid, say, from a chicken that's in the pan. I'm reducing it until it caramelizes. It's the instant it caramelizes, there's this wonderful aroma that comes up. And my cat used to come screaming as soon as he would smell this. So that's one example of using smell. I don't know what sense have I left. Taste is obvious.
Right.
I think I covered them all.
Well, and touch is an interesting thing because unless you've worked like as a grill cook, the whole idea of what exactly that touch feels like can be a somewhat of a mystery. And you had a really great analogy of how to easily determine, like when you're cooking steaks or grilling outside, what that touch feels like. And you said it's a muscle at the base of your thumb.
Yes, yes. If you clench it, if you tighten the thumb, that muscle will become firm. As you relax the thumb, it becomes loose, and that becomes the equivalent of raw meat. If it's tight, that's, as soon as it starts to tighten, that's indicative that the meat is getting heated in the middle. Mm-hmm. So if you wait till that barely starts, you're going to have medium rare, which is a little underdone for pork. You take it a little farther until it's completely bouncing back, and no farther than that. As soon as it bounces back entirely, you stop. You don't wait. And by this time, it should be releasing red juices.
Mm-hmm. Now, that was the other thing, the formation of juices. You tell a lot by what color the juices are, what it looks like.
Yes. The juices initially start forming around the bone. There's a bone in it, in a chop, say. And they're initially red. And as the meat cooks, it's especially noticeable on a steak, because as it's medium rare, it'll start to release red juices. And then as it approaches medium, the juices start to turn. And they're still reddish, but they're starting to turn brown. And as you get overcooked, then you're in brown juices that run a lot. You'll see a lot of juices.
And that's basically the moisture of the meat sweating out any moisture that you had in the meat, right?
Yeah, exactly. Now, it makes a wonderful sauce. but the meat is dry.
My guest today is James Peterson, award-winning food writer and cookbook author. His latest book is basically a whole book about when foods are done. It's titled Done, A Cook's Guide to Knowing When Food is Perfectly Cooked. And you did a lot of picture work, too, in this. You had a lot of photography to show the various stages. You know, we're talking not just meats. We're talking vegetables. We're talking eggs. We're talking fish. We're talking sauces. The whole gamut of food, and there's a lot of little tricks in this book. Talk about how you basically put this thing together.
It's funny, my assistant and I. Well, what are we going to do today? Because we'd think just spontaneously what we hadn't covered yet. There was no real systematic approach to what I chose over another thing. We'd just find something good at the butcher or the fish store. Oh, let's do this. So there was no system, really. But the system, once we had the product, was to show people, first off, how to cook it such that you don't have problems with it being done, so that you don't burn it or screw it up or make it such that all the liquid pours out of it. So we started to illustrate that. Then that was how we approached it. We approached what the best way of cooking things was first.
Yeah, and that's the other thing is you go through the various techniques, which most people are mostly familiar with. Although I think in my case, you know, I think of certain techniques as being only one type of technique and for only certain things. And for example, braising. I always think of a real slow braise for like really tough cuts of meat that you're going to tenderize over time. But you mentioned that there's a whole different variety of braising techniques.
Yes, I divide them into four things, or four methods, which can be combined. Two of the methods are slow braising and long braising. And what you're saying, of course, is slow braising. But short braising will be an example of a fish. You put, say, fillets of fish, a little sherry sprinkled over, maybe a little butter, and you bake it for 5 minutes or 8 minutes, depending on how thick they are. So that's short braising. Then there's also brown braising or white braising, and that simply means, did you brown the meat first, or did you not? Mm-hmm. Now, an example of using white braising would be, say, you're making a post-veal stew. And one of the things you have to do with veal is you have to blanch it first. Most people don't realize that. They think, oh, you're losing all the juices, but you're not. You blanch it, you drain it, because it releases a lot of cloudy, gray, revolting, soapy-tasting stuff that you don't want in your stew. So you blanch it first, rinse it all off, and then put it in with your braise. And then the braising liquid comes out beautifully clear.
Now, obviously, a lot of people think of poaching as only for eggs, and you come up with a variety of different ways you can poach food. And basically, poaching means completely submerging it in liquid. But it's different from boiling.
Yes. It just means you don't boil it. You can't let it boil or get cloudy and greasy and muddy and all those horrible things, and even get dry. But you can do that with just about anything. You can do it with meat or fish, or it's quite versatile.
My guest today is James Peterson, award-winning food writer and cookbook author. His new book is titled Done, A Cook's Guide to Knowing When Food is Cooked Perfectly. And you even started something as basic as a hard-boiled egg.
Yes. And people are always asking me why their eggs are gray inside or have a ring of green or black. And that's simply because they overcook them.
And you go through this is one of the most interesting parts because this is a food that you do have to cook by time, correct?
Yes. There's no other way of judging its doneness.
Yeah. And you show us every style of egg, a 2 minute egg, a 4 minute egg, a 5 minute egg, a 6 minute egg, a 7, 8, a 10, and then the 15 minute egg, which again has that brown, gray tinged yolk.
Yes. Well, at least you can't say I'm not obsessive.
No.
But yes, we show all the stages. And one stage that people don't appreciate is what the French call a smolet, which is that stage between hard-boiled and soft-boiled, mm-hmm. where the yolk is set, but it's not opaque. It's shiny still. And that's a nice way of cooking eggs, say that you're going to toss in a salad.
Interesting. Yeah. No. And I assume there are people that like a hard-boiled egg, too, as well.
Yes. I tend to like my hard-boiled eggs a little sheen inside, which is not what most people want, not what most people expect.
And by sheen, you mean it has some looseness in it and it's shiny?
It's shiny, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Now, you go through a variety of food meats, and chicken and pork are probably the ones that are most overcooked. What are some of the hints that you have for making sure that the chicken is done but it's not overcooked?
Well, I use temperature for that. Well, in the old days in France, we used to stick a skewer in it, a metal skewer, and hold it to our lip. And you were supposed to be able to judge temperature by that.
I read that, and that just sounds like it could be very painful.
you use a thermometer, and you stick it right in the skin that's formed between the thigh and the breast. You stick it through that, and you stick it down near to where the thigh bone joins the back, deep inside the chicken. But you don't let it touch the bone. You hold it back a little bit from the bone. And then I say to measure it to 140. Now, 140, to my mind, is even a little bit overcooked. But I'm not going to say that because people get really weird. I would really cook it to 135 because as it rests, it's going to hit 140. But I'm not going to say that. It's too weird for people.
So
I cook it to 140 with the warning that it's a little pink. And I put foil loosely over the breast for the first part of the cooking. People go through all these machinations to make roast chicken, and I do it in the simplest way. I take the chicken breast tied up, cover it loosely with buttered foil, bake it or roast it for about 20 minutes, then take the foil off and finish the roasting. And that slows the cooking time of the breast such that when the temperature reaches 140, your breast meat isn't reading 160 and overcooked.
Now, the other thing is you also can tell doneness by checking the juices from the bird. And you actually have a couple of diagrams that show the first part of the roasting process when it's still undercooked. And it sort of almost looks like a little Pepto-Bismol-y in a way. It's sort of reddish, but a little reddy, yeah. And then when it's a real sort of dark brothy red, it's done. When it runs clear, it's overcooked.
Yes, yes. Now, most people say it should run clear, that when the red bits in there, it's undercooked. But I found once it's clear and there are little spots of red in it, it's cooked. If it's clear completely, then it's overcooked.
Hmm. Now, you also have a big section on vegetables. And, of course, vegetables are something Americans really like to overcook because most of us grew up with overcooked vegetables.
I know, things out of a can.
And now we kind of go to the opposite extreme. We're eating broccoli and green beans where it's practically raw. And there's sort of a middle ground there, isn't there?
There sure is, Rich. And I wish that people would get the point. Because I go to restaurants nowadays, and the beans are always undercooked. They're crunchy, and I don't like that. I like the beans have a remnant of crunchiness, just the slightest remnant of crunchiness. So it means cooking them a few more minutes, not a lot more. But that's how I determine doneness. I just reach in and grab one. Although, actually, I wouldn't tell people to do this, but when I'm stirring that with a spoon, if I just kind of take a spoon in there, or a wooden spoon or whatever, just stir the beans around in the boiling water, I can tell by the feeling of the beans against the wooden spoon how they bounce, whether they're done or not. Just from having done it for so many years.
Yeah.
But the best way to do it, the realistic way to do it, is just take one out and bite into it.
Now, we were talking about broccoli a moment ago, and steamed broccoli is very popular these days. But, you know, when you go to a restaurant, a lot of times that broccoli is perfectly just that beautiful, bright green. A lot of times at home kitchens, it kind of goes a little gray. Is that from overcooking, or is that something else?
Well, it's from overcooking, Rich, and also the theory, at least the old French theory, was that if you cook something covered, if you took something green and cooked it covered, apparently green foods release some kind of acid that vaporizes, and if it's trapped, it can cause the beans to go gray. Now, I don't really know if this is true, but that's what they said. So steaming might not be the best system. The old system is to blanch them in boiling water. Now, people seem to think that takes the vitamins out of them, but steaming does too, because they release their own juices with the vitamins into the bottom of the steamer. So it's the same deal. And I think you get a greener result. Also, you put a lot of salt in the water, which helps the greenness.
Yeah. Now, you also have a section on, like, your basic sauces, like hollandaise and things like that. I found this really interesting because, you know, there's so many things can go wrong in these processes where you're cooking for a long time and having to stir like you do with risotto or making a roux or a hollandaise sauce. What are some of the secrets on those particular things?
Well, risotto is another one of those. It's hard to kind of look at. I mean, if you do it all the time, you can probably start to learn by what it looks like. But I'm not at that stage. I just take a piece and bite into it. Now, the other thing to see if it's done, it should have just the slightest remnant of starchiness inside, barely perceptible. But what a lot of people do is or worry about is how thick it is. And it's funny because in different parts of Italy, they use different thicknesses. And in Venice, they have it quite watery, quite runny, which actually is the way I prefer it. But that's easily enough controlled by how much liquid you add.
Now, sauces are an interesting thing. You have a whole section on holiday sauce, which, you know, is one of those great things that most of us here at home, we can't do a really great hollandaise sauce unless we've had a lot of practice and a lot of throwaways to get to that point. What are some of the things you need to keep in mind? Because this is an emulsion, and it's basically two things that don't want to be combined.
Well, exactly. And the trick is you first make what's called a sabayon. You take the egg yolks, and you mix them a little bit of cold water, and you whisk them over, not in a double boiler. That overcooks things in a second. I hold it right over the bowl, metal bowl, right over the flame on the stove, the tiniest flame, and beat it until it stiffens. Now, this is the only tricky part, really, because you don't want it to curdle, of course, and turn into scrambled eggs. And what I recommend to people is just get a couple dozen eggs and practice. You'll get it down after that many attempts. And what you do is you want it between the thin, normal-looking phase and the overcooked phase. So you want it to stiffen such that when you're whisking, you see the bottom of the bowl. You see the traces of the whisk that form on the bottom of the bowl. And once you form that sabayon, you can whisk in the butter rather quickly because the emulsion's already formed.
Mm.
So it makes it much easier once you get that. The sabayon is the tricky part.
And, of course, you also have ways in which when those do separate, when your emulsion breaks down, ways of saving it, too.
Yes, there are ways. It's a little tricky if you've gone too far, but you can sometimes reverse it if you barely overcooked it. You can reverse it by just taking it off the heat immediately and whisking it really fast. I've done that. I've cheated, you know, and there's little imperceptible specks in the hollandaise, but no one notices those, so I don't worry too much.
Yeah. Well, the name of the book is Done, A Cook's Guide to Knowing When Food is Cooked Perfectly, filled with pictures that sort of give you a very good look. But, of course, as James writes, you have to use all your senses, and it means not only smelling, you're listening to the food on the grill to make sure that the grill's the right temperature, and using a touch, and it's a really fascinating book. What's been the reaction so far from this?
People are interested in it. People seem to respond to it. I think people like titles that are one word. And I don't know if you notice it, very few people notice it, but it's done, period.
Yeah.
That period is part of the title, which to me is a little problematic because you're reading, you know, blah, 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 about done, and suddenly there's a period in there. So you can't italicize a period. So what do you do? It looks weird.
The one thing that this book doesn't do is tell you how to balance everything so that you can get everything the perfect doneness when you're cooking for guests, Because it's one thing to get one thing right, but to do the dance to get everything done at approximately the same time, that's the real trick of things.
That is a trick, and it's a question of timing and anticipating about, and you can't do it perfectly, you can't miss something, but anticipating to some degree when things are going to be done. So, of course, you put the steaks on, and you kind of know, and okay, let me fire up the green beans, and the potatoes have been in the oven 45 minutes or 50 minutes, so we're on course for those. It's all a matter of timing. Anticipating about how long things are going to take. And, of course, they don't come out all at once. But most foods are pretty forgiving if you need to hold them on the stove. And if you don't, if they are unforgiving, I just serve that particular course and not worry too much about the other things, which can be served a little later.
That's a good way to think about it. That's great. Well, the name of the book is Done, A Cook's Guide to Knowing When Food is Cooked Perfectly. James Peterson, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Rich.
Food writer, cookbook author, and former restaurant cook, James Peterson, speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His latest book is titled Done, A Cook's Guide to Knowing When Food is Perfectly Cooked. It's published by Chronicle Books. You're listening to Studio Tulsa.
Down every morning, 10 times, not just now and then. Give that chicken fat back to the chicken, and don't be chicken again. No, don't be chicken again.
If you watch much of the World Cup or the NBA Finals, you've probably heard this unusual song as part of Apple's latest commercial campaign. And if you're like me, this revived a lot of old memories of gym and PE class. So where did this crazy chicken fat song come from? Interestingly, there's a couple of Oklahoma connections. It's one of the first projects the Presidential Council on Physical Fitness, whose director at the time was OU football coach Bud Wilkinson. In 1962, council members got together with Meredith Wilson, composer of The Music Man, to write a song that would promote physical fitness. Wilson, then busy with the film adaptation of The Music Man, got his star, Robert Preston, to record it. In fact, there were two versions, a two-minute version designed for radio play, and then on the B-side, a seven-minute version for actual use in gym class. Now here's the second Oklahoma connection. The U.S. Junior Chamber of Commerce, the JCs, headquartered in Tulsa for many, many years, sent free copies of the records to schools around the country. And because of this ad campaign, we're finding out that this song is still being used in PE classics some 50 years later. How my school, Pratt Elementary, built in 1970, got this is a question for another day.
Now struggle up to your feet, struggle, march in place, march.
Studio Tulsa is going to march out of here. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.
Right, left, and halt. One, two, next, sit-ups. Everybody's favorite, so on your back, drop. All right, girls, you're in this too. Arms overhead, flop. Come on, girls, now sit up. Sit down.
Every morning.
Up, 10 times. Sit up, down.
On your feet.
Up, down.
Five.
Swing that rusty gate.
Six.
Don't drop the tempo, mate. Can't win dragging your feet.
No, can't win dragging your feet.
Your feet up, everybody, hands on hips, place, twist your trunk to the left, ready, twist left, front,
now the right side.